When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Henry River Mill Village. What happened in the haunted Henry River Mill Village? What happens when a small town's only industry burns to the ground? An industry that provided more than just a job to its residents. It provided them with housing, currency, education, and an entire way of life. This is the story of what some may view as a once utopian settlement, now rotting in the deep backwoods of rural North Carolina. This is the story of the haunted Henry River Mill Village, as we discuss it with Soul Sisters paranormal investigator, Christy Sumner.
And what this is a story of the textile industry, specifically in North Carolina. So after the Civil War, North Carolina, its infrastructure was pretty much decimated. So in order to kind of get back to some semblance of order, they really tried to rely on the resources that they still had after the Civil War. And two of those strong resources were a willing workforce as well as water power in the form of rivers, because they had numerous rivers that ran throughout the state. And so what they did is they utilized that water power to create textile mills. And it really led to a resurgence of the textile industry after the Civil War has just decimated that infrastructure. So, for example, between 1850 and 1860, there were only about 39 textile mills in North Carolina. But by 1870, which is about 5 years after the end of the Civil War, there were 113 mills in North Carolina. These are textile mills, and they were producing about $3 million of revenue annually in those textile products. Between 1923 and by 1923, there were 351 mills operating in North Carolina at the tune of $326 million of products annually coming out of North Carolina. So what they really tried to do was capitalize on that labor force. So the mills would start creating what they call mill villages. And those were pretty much self-contained societies, if you will. And they were created by the mill owners in order to really keep the mill workers in one central location. So, for example, they would build houses, schools, churches, general stores, all of these around the mill, and they would become self-sustaining. They were essentially planned communities. So within those communities, they're guiding the social, the political, the religious, the educational activities of all of these residents. So like I said, it really became this self-sustaining workforce. And the workers got something out of it because they've got housing now and a community, that sense of community, and the mills were getting a full family workforce. So the men were working in the mills, the women were working in the mills, the children were working in the mills, so they could draw on that from a very, ready source, if you will. So essentially, when it boils down to it, it was a social structure designed to capitalize on that workforce. So specifically, Henry River Mill Village came into existence in 1905, and it was the product of the Henry River Manufacturing Company. And so two families by the name of Adderholt and Rudisill, they decided to go ahead and build this mill village around the mill, again in 1905. And they also created this fully self-contained, community. So they produced their own electricity. They produced moonshine. They actually created their own currency, which was called doogaloos. And you could spend these doogaloos in the community itself, or you could exchange them for, American money, if you will, to spend outside of the community. But within the community, you could spend these doogaloos and buy things at the general store or trade them, or that's how they got paid. So you can put that on credit at the general store. So that was kind of an interesting thing that they did. But again, it provided that social community for the residents. So specific to Henry River Mill, they built 35 houses for these workers. There was a two-story boarding house. There was a company store. There was a church, a school, along with the three-story textile mill. And they were able to really produce a lot of yarn at that time because of this structure. So in 1905, when they first opened, they were operating about 4,000 spindles of yarn. By the height of their operation, they were operating 12,000 spindles and producing about 15,000 pounds of spun yarn each week was coming out of the Henry River Mill Manufacturing Company. So again, this communal structure was where the residents were born, they lived, they worked, they played, they socialized, they died, all within this essentially a 60-acre community. And that lasted until about 1977 when the mill actually burned down. They believe it started by a lightning strike, but it did burn the mill down. And most of the residents left at that time, but there were a handful of them that stayed in the village up until as late as the late 1990s, early 2000s. So that, in a nutshell, is the history of Henry River Mill Village.
Wow. So, I mean, this thing, it really had been home to people for nearly a century here, it seems like. Is mm-hmm. that accurate? Okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
What was life like in that mill village? I mean, it's interesting, from the outside looking in or from the inside looking out is really going to be two different perspectives. And another thing you have mm-hmm. to look at it from is the filter of time and what was life like, a lot of it being survival. So mm-hmm. in one way, we can look at this and go, Well, that seems insanely controlling there to have your own currency and everything's pretty much has its own little ecosystem. And if you're fine with that, I guess that works out. But, you know, you can't really go beyond those barriers because that's, you know, it's the control that that company has. And that really is how a lot of companies functioned in this country at that point in time. So really, it's not a foreign concept, but you have to look at it, too, going, you know, on the inside, you would feel, I would think at some level, yes, you're taken care of, but there must be some, you know, inside things going on there where you feel, well, you know, that's, you know, the company store, they're doing this or that, or they're, you know, if we want to live here and be peaceful, we got to kind of, you got to go along with it. You got to, you know, toe the line. You can't really ruffle many feathers if you want to keep your income and your life and your home and all that. So what was life like for the individuals that were living there at that time?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when we actually went to investigate this location, there were people that came up and spoke to us, because we took a day tour before. And so there were people that came up and spoke to us and said, we used to live here. I used to live here. I used to live in that house right there. And all indications that we got were that it was a life that to them was pretty much idyllic, in the fact that they had jobs. They knew where they were going to work every day. Mm-hmm. They knew where they were going to go to school. They knew where, you know, their neighbors were and their neighbors' belief system and all of that. Now, you know, you did have the opportunity to leave if you wanted. It's not like a prison sentence,
sure.
But a majority of them chose to stay because that's what they were born into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you can walk out of your front door and literally walk down, you know, 50 yards and you're at work, that's pretty convenient. Or when you just walk across the street and there's the general store, that's pretty convenient. I'm sure there were some residents that felt stifled in a way,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, maybe they did feel like, you know, this is kind of what their cycle of existence was supposed to be. But all indications that we have through our research was, you know, it was a place that was happy. The residents, you know, looked out for each other because it was so close-knit. I mean, if you had a problem, somebody was there to help you. If your car broke down or something, somebody was there to help you. And for all indications of what we found is that the residents, that lifestyle was what they were willing to abide by to have those steady jobs in the mill.
Sure. So it's a trade-off, essentially. And at that point in time, it could be a very lucrative one.
Mm-hmm.
As far as life there and when the fire occurred in the 1960s, if I heard correctly.
1977.
Yeah. So lightning mm-hmm. strikes, factory burns down. What is the state of the town in the 70s as far as how life is going there? And then obviously it burns, and from what I understand, it didn't come back. What was going on at that point as far as life goes there at Henry River Mill Village?
Well, they continued to live there. Some of the residents did move out. We're talking in Hildebrand, North Carolina, so it's not that far from Hickory.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the residents did move out. But as I said, there was a handful of them that stayed in that village and just continued life and got jobs outside of the mill work, farming and so forth, or in another textile mill. But they continued to live in that village in the homes that they knew. And so I want to say there was at least 7 or 8 families, if I'm correct, that stayed in those houses up until the late 1990s, early 2000s.
Wow.
Again, you know, if that's your home, it's now we're at an inconvenient point where you can't step outside and go to your job, but, you know, you still have your house, and we're going to go ahead and find jobs elsewhere, seek jobs elsewhere.
Why did the mill never never reconstructed or reopened?
I just think at that point, you started to see a decline in the textile industry, you know, by the 1960s. A lot of the textile products were starting to come from overseas rather than domestically produced. So the mill was kind of in a decline by the mid-1960s. So it wasn't lucrative to rebuild the mill. It was a huge building. Some of the historical photos that we found, it was a 3-story mill. It had, you know, thousands and thousands of spindles that were producing this yarn. And so it just was not at that point lucrative to rebuild, because all of that textile was most of the country was now getting it imported rather than domestically made.
Sure. So it just makes sense at some point to say, this mm-hmm.
yeah,
will,
it
will
wasn't.
Come back.
It wasn't. It was cost prohibitive.
Sure. Like many, many industries in this country. Let's talk about as far as so life goes on. People are there into the early 2000s. Eventually, I'm assuming they just kind of move out and things. People mm-hmm. move on with their lives, and then the town sits.
It does. It absolutely sits. It becomes abandoned. It's interesting because there is a county road that runs through it. So when you come up on it, you see residential houses, not part of the village, but you see these residential houses just like, you know, kind of any street in North Carolina, really. And then you just turn this corner and boom, there are these houses, you know, built in, you know, the 1930s and 40s, these wooden structures. And it's kind of a surreal experience. And then you pull into the parking lot by the general store. But yeah, it's set abandoned. And then a private owner bought the entire village, I want to say in the early 2000s. The actual date escapes me at this time. You know, he just kind of sat on it. And then the producers of the movie The Hunger Game sought it out as a filming location for District 12 in The Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. So that brought a lot of recognition to it. And they got a big plaque outside saying District 12 of The Hunger Games now. The gentleman that had it, he since sold it, and now it's back in the hands of private owners. They have it open for tours, day tours, paranormal tours, and so on.
Well, take us in the timeline of this town as far as the research you've done and found. Where do you trace back the initial paranormal or ghost stories of Henry River Mill Village? Do they begin with the residents when they were still living there, or are these sort of things stories that have been found after the fact?
Honestly, I believe they've been found after the fact. In our research, you know, we really didn't find any categorized stories of historical of paranormal evidence or anything like that while the mill was in operation or while the families lived there. Once it closed down and it became abandoned, you know, you do have those people that trespass, for lack of a better word, into these locations, and some stories start to trickle out. But some of the stories that we found started dating back, you know, into the early 2000s, when some paranormal people went in there. And what we wanted to do was kind of validate that. And to us, kind of what we found in our investigation seemed very residual, because again, you've got, like you said, almost a century of life that is completely in this town, you know, from birth to life, to work, to play, to social activities, to death, and all that is housed in this one small community. So it saw a lot during its time, families upon families, you know, living and working and dying in this same location. So for us, the evidence that we found seemed to indicate that there was a lot of residual evidence. We did get some intelligent responses to some of our experiments, I think the residual is what intrigued us the most.
Sure. Well, you think of it, just the sheer amount of people that came and went and all those life experiences mm-hmm. that were spent there, then suddenly everyone is gone. I mean, obviously, just walking through there without knowing anything or any story of anything paranormal, it would just give you creepy vibes, just these abandoned buildings, mm-hmm. just kind of going, this is spooky. Mm-hmm. So that could certainly draw someone in to want to ask more questions. What were some of the first accounts of people actually having experiences there, you know, in the early 2000s, when people did start to try to go in and investigate and see what's up, if anything, there? Because it doesn't sound like this was triggered by anything where people were like, oh, did you hear of the ghost down at the Henry Mill Village General Store? It was more so, this looks like a creepy building. Let's see what the hell's going on, if there is anything going on. And it turns mm-hmm. out, yeah, it seems like there was some stuff going on. What were some of those early stories that were found?
A lot of it had to do with footsteps, bangs, noises, that sort of thing. That was the indication that we got during our research. And, you know, while there is a county road that runs through it, it is somewhat isolated. And if it's something that you go through every day or around every day, you know, it's kind of like me down here in Florida with Disney World. It's Disney World, you know, kind of, I think so. Some of the residents that live near there now, it's just kind of like, that's Henry River Mill Village. So that when in talking to the owners, when we did our investigation, you know, they have had claims of paranormal activity. Some investigators that have gone in there have found absolutely nothing. And I do think that, you know, that could be the case with a lot of locations, but, for us, we just kind of wanted to go in and kind of see if we could validate some of the footsteps, you know, the bangs. People have seen apparitions in there, specifically in the general store, and then a couple of the other houses that are there. There's probably, I want to say there's 13 houses that are still standing along with the general store, which is almost fully intact, save the windows that have been kind of broken out. And the current owners are restoring some of those houses. But, you know, when you go in, you have to climb through the windows of some of these houses. And the stairs, you know, are ones you look at and like, you know, do I really want to risk my life climbing up there tonight? So it is, as you said, a very creepy vibe when you walk in. There's only one street light that is there in the middle of the town. So it does kind of give off that eerie vibe. But the current owners are doing a tremendous job in my book of really trying to bring it back with the historical tours and the paranormal, but more so with the historical tours, kind of giving people an insight of what it was like during that time. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question in a very long-winded way, the stories that we got were knocks, bangs, a few apparitions and the such, and that's what we were going in to find.
And what were the experiences that you had when you went in, when you first went in and arrived in this town and said, okay, we're going to do some investigating. We're going to see what we can find, see if we can verify any of these stories or have some experiences of our own. For you personally, what was it like? What was it like as you went into the town? What were you feeling?
Okay. Well, let me set the stage quickly to our investigation. So obviously I have a team. I've got a team of five female investigators. However, I had been following for a few months prior, another female investigator by the name of Miranda Young, and she is with Ghost Biker Explorations. So I asked her if she wanted to join me in just a collaborative effort with just she and I going to a location. And so for us, North Carolina is a pretty central point. So we decided on Henry River Mill Village. So the two of us, we had never met before. We had met the night before just to kind of go over our styles. So we had never met before, and this was going to be our first investigation together. So it was a very collaborative investigation. So she, you know, kind of took some of the styles that I use, and I took some of the styles that she used. And to us, it was just an amazing collaboration and a show of para-unity, if you will, for this location. So what we did is we took a day tour, which is what we do before we go to any location, to kind of familiarize ourselves with the surroundings. And, you know, we walked through all of that. The owners gave us permission to climb through the windows of these houses, you know, go into the general store, which is three stories. It has it has a basement, the main level, and then the second level, which is pretty cool. And so we went in with the mindset of, again, trying to verify some of those paranormal experiences that others have had, as well as see if we can find, you know, our own evidence. So when we went in the night of the investigation, you know, we both set up a static night vision video cameras. So we divided those up and, you know, we put them in five of the houses, as well as each level of the general store. And there's also a bridge that runs over the river, and that's reported to have a spirit that is underneath that bridge. So we put a voice recorder and a night vision video camera up underneath that bridge to see if we could capture anything. Miranda uses dowsing rods. I have never used dowsing rods before, so she used those to some very interesting results. And then she also introduced me to the Estes method, which if you're not familiar with that, it utilizes the spirit box. And so she introduced me to that, and we had some really amazing results doing that as well. So overall, what we found was, as I said before, a lot of residual paranormal activity, what we call paranormal residual activity, as well as some intelligent responses to some of our experiments.
Let's talk about some of those experiences and some of the responses that you got. Tell me about some of the more impactful experiments that you did that you walked away from going, wow, that was quite a response we got there.
Okay. Well, as I said, I had never used the Estes method before. And, you know, for some of your listeners who may not be familiar with that, what you do is you take a spirit box, and a spirit box is, for general terms, an AM/FM radio that's been converted to very quickly sweep through channels. So when you're listening to a spirit box and you're sweeping through channels, essentially you hear a and you're not expected to hear full phrases. So if you have a full phrase, it's very likely that that could be a spirit using its energy to speak through the static, if you will. So what the Estes method does is you have one investigator who has noise-canceling headphones connected to that spirit box, and she's also blindfolded. So it is essentially a deprivation experiment, if you will. So all of her senses are now focused in on that spirit box and its responses. She cannot hear the questions that I'm asking, and she cannot see her environment. So Miranda put on the headphones, she put on the blindfold, she connected the headphones to the spirit box, and I stepped out into another room. So I was probably, I'd say, 40 feet from Miranda in another room. And So I started asking questions, and the responses that Miranda was getting, that she would say that she was getting through the spirit box, were interesting because they were mirroring some of the questions that I asked. So for example, I asked, what's your name? And immediately she said the word Clyde. Again, she can't hear my questions, so the fact that she said the name Clyde was very interesting. And then just, you know, because I had a deck of cards with me, I wanted to try something. So I picked up a deck of cards and I flipped to one card, and it happened to be the Six of Spades. And I said, can you tell me what number is on this card? So Miranda said a few other words, and then she said the number six, which to me was extremely interesting because that was the number on the card. And then also during the night, we had the owners requested that we had a guard with us. So the gentleman's name was Adam, and he was an off-duty law enforcement officer. So he stayed outside while we were doing these experiments. And I asked, while we were still doing the Estes method, I asked, do you want me to go get Adam? And immediately Miranda said, police. And again, she can't hear these questions, so there's no reason why she would say the word police or hear the word police on the spirit box. So to me, that was fascinating, especially never having done the Estes method before. You know, having Miranda say police to me was very, very compelling evidence, if you will.
It is.
So that was one of the. Go ahead.
Okay, that is very compelling. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that was pretty interesting to us. Again, Miranda used her dowsing rods, which, again, I don't use, but she had some very interesting responses on those. Like, for example, can you point to, you know, the house where we were standing outside? Can you point to the house where you lived or were born? And, you know, her dowsing rods would point to those locations. So to me, that was very compelling as well. And then when we went back and listened and watched our audio and video footage from that night, We caught some very interesting things. We had set up a night vision video camera to run in what would have been the kitchen area of one of these houses. And so just to digress a little bit, because there is a road that kind of runs off to one side of the village, there is a little bit of light, noise pollution in the form of cars. Now, they didn't run all night, but there are cars that run through. But other than that, this is a very dark, desolate place. And so, you know, we very quickly can rule out that there's nobody else in the house. There's nobody near the house because of the way we position the cameras. We can see the surrounding areas as well. So back to my story, the camera was sitting in what would have been the kitchen of the house. And we had several responses during the night, or several EVPs during the night. One said, step aside. One said, what is it? It said, this is cold, which to us meant it's either, you know, the food is cold or something like that, which, you know, again, to us is very compelling. And then we had several other voices that we picked up that night, along with some very substantial footsteps that pretty much plomped across the floor there in front of the camera. We didn't catch anything visual on that camera, but you could definitely hear footsteps when you can absolutely see that there's nobody else in the house. So that was compelling. And then we had another night vision camera set up in a house, and it was on the back wall, so it had been facing what would have been the front door, and the door is there. So you see us walking out of the door and shutting it, and you can hear us shut it. And about 45 minutes later, approximately, you hear the latch on the door click, and there's nobody around. And then slowly the door swings open. And this is the night where it was completely still. You know, it was in July. There's nothing moving. There's no wind, but the door slowly pulls open. And, you know, we caught a couple of EVPs there, along with a voice saying, "I'm Billy," which to us, again, is very compelling evidence. So overall for us, it was a fantastic night of paranormal investigation for sure.
Is there any, in your continued research on this, you got some names that were called out. Were you able to connect those to any former residents or anything that may be on record from being there?
Well, honestly, you know, it's tough to do that because there's so many people that have lived through that community during the time of its existence.
Sure.
So we did ask some of the residents that we spoke to, the former residents, and sure, they said, yeah, there was Billy's or Bill's or Williams. So it's kind of tough to narrow that down. But, you know, my belief is there absolutely was somebody named Billy in that village at one time, whether it's the EVP that we, you know, the person that said the EVP, I can't tell. I can't verify that. But to us, it was very compelling, and it was very clear on the audio what it said.
Sure. Sure. Having that been your first time doing the Estes method with the spirit box, obviously you're in this field, you've heard of spirit boxes before. It wasn't your first time seeing it, or you're hearing, or you maybe even using a spirit box in some way, shape, or form. What to you with the spirit box, was that one of the more compelling methods of using it? Spirit boxes, obviously, there's people who think they are the best thing in the world as far as getting evidence. Some people think it's complete hogwash and you shouldn't ever use one. And then you have kind of everybody in between. It's like, well, there's certain ways that this tool can work as directed. But as far as it being a tool for gathering evidence and gathering information, what's your opinion on the device in general? And then as far as best practices for getting results out of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, for just my opinion in general, we go into an investigation with a variety of equipment. And to me, the spirit box, it has some compelling aspects. You know, I'll go back to our Ma Barker investigation just briefly. When that spirit box is moving quickly through AM radio stations and the full phrase says, "Someone's up here," to me, there's no way that can happen. You know, those radio frequencies would have to be in complete sync to get that phrase completely. We were upstairs in the room at that time, and it said, "Someone's up here." So to me, that was completely compelling. But what we do is we don't rely on one piece of equipment on any of our investigations. We take each piece individually and look at what happened, and then we use that to validate what we're getting on other pieces of equipment. Now, if we went in and it was just the spirit box giving those answers at that time, I would say, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sold that this is, you know, answering our question specifically. But when you add that up with the fact that Adam was a police officer, that I was holding up the number 6 of a card, that the, you know, underneath in the basement, we had just had a great flashlight session, that Miranda's dowsing rods were, you know, having some pretty good hits as well. And that we were catching some other stuff on the cameras and our audio. When you compound that all together, to me, it becomes absolutely more compelling.
Sure.
So to answer your question again, very long-windedly, we use that as one tool in a variety of tools to validate what we're seeing.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Christy Sumner about the haunted Henry River Mill Village. In part two of our conversation, what have been some of the most compelling pieces of evidence that Christy has ever found using a spirit box? What makes Christy think that a majority of the spirits in the haunted Henry River Mill Village are residual energy? What has been the reaction from former residents of the Henry River Mill Village to the paranormal research being conducted there? And what does the future hold for this small town that now sits alone? Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Brisky. Thanks for listening.